From recent high-profile endorsements to answering her critics, State Attorney Angela Corey is on the campaign trail and on the air this morning. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show always live at 9. And now, subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, State Attorney Angela Corey talks criminal justice in North Florida and takes your calls. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, First Coast young adult author Meg Haston on her growing success around the country. Also, a preview of The Whale. That's the new show debuting this weekend at Jacksonville's Five and Dime Theater. All of that ahead this hour. But first this morning, State Attorney Angela Corey recently won two high-profile endorsements as she seeks re-election from former Sheriff John Rutherford and property appraiser Jerry Holland. Corey's fundraising is also far outpacing her challenger in the race, former Assistant State Attorney Wes White. White has criticized Corey for her handling of several high-profile cases and for the way the Fourth Judicial Circuit handles juvenile offenders, among other things. White was recently a guest on this program. This morning, State Attorney Corey joins us in studio to talk about her record, the campaign, and take your calls. State Attorney Angela Corey, welcome back to the studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's good to be here.
And the calls are already flowing in. What are your calls and questions for State Attorney Angela Corey? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And let's begin with the positive news that former Sheriff John Rutherford and former Supervisor of Elections, now property appraiser Jerry Holland, coming out and endorsing your campaign for re-election. Had to feel good to win those two well-known individuals coming on board with your campaign.
It is, Melissa. It's a great honor to have those on top of the others that we've already garnered. So we're very excited about the amount of support we're getting. We've gotten financial support from Sheriff Beasler and Sheriff Williams as well. They were with us for our campaign kickoff. We're very excited about this campaign, and it's going in a very, very positive direction.
As you campaign on your record for re-election as state attorney, what themes will you stress?
Well, we'll stress the truth, and we are having to rebut a lot of misinformation, which I've been trying to do for the last several years. So we will continue to get our message out. We want people to understand that there are facts that don't come out and can't possibly come out because the criminal justice system is such a complicated beast. It is so complicated, and it's difficult to try to get an entire story out or an explanation based on law.
You recently penned an op-ed that was published in the Florida Times Union where you talked about what you said were agenda-driven individuals who ignore the truth and have spread myths about, in particular, your office's prosecution of juveniles. I wanted to ask you in a little more depth about that. It's your contention that your office has been misrepresented when it comes to the way you handled juveniles.
Absolutely. It's been misrepresented. I celebrated my 34th year in the state attorney's office yesterday. Ed Austin hired me in 1981. I started in the juvenile division. Nothing in the philosophy of the Fourth Judicial Circuit has changed drastically enough to warrant this kind of false criticism, or the criticism that's based on false facts, I should have said. We have always had to use direct file, grand jury, and certification procedures to put juveniles into the adult system where the juvenile system is not equipped to handle them. The Florida statutes tell us when we should put juveniles into the adult system. And obviously, murder is the foremost crime for which we should put a juvenile into the adult system. So we're operating under statutes, under case law, and we're doing a good job of only putting those in adult court where juvenile cannot possibly solve the problem.
And we'll go to your calls for State Attorney Angela Corey in just a moment. We also want your emails and tweets. The number to join us is 549-2937. In February of 2014, an investigative report in the Times Union, and I quote, wrote that the Fourth Judicial Circuit, which consists of Duval, Clay, and Nassau counties, dramatically leads the state in the number of juveniles incarcerated through a method called direct commitment, a plea deal reached between a juvenile's lawyer and the prosecutor. And the reporter Topher Sanders, who's no longer with this paper, wrote, When juveniles agree to this deal, they're incarcerated without the chance to hear evidence against them, examine police work, or interview witnesses. According to Rob Mason with the Public Defender's Office and Matt Shirk, the public defender, both quoted in the story, the juvenile is threatened with adult charges if they don't take the deal. What about that allegation?
That allegation came after we proved over and over again that they had lied, saying we led the country in juvenile direct files. We have actually always been sort of middle of the pack. We're at ninth right now. So once we kept continuing to prove with the statistics we don't lead in juvenile direct files, they switched focus to direct commitment. We don't threaten.
What's the difference between direct file and direct commitment?
A direct file is where we put a juvenile up into an adult court without a grand jury or judicial intervention. And it's that decision is based on the seriousness of the crime, the record of the offender, and whether or not we can do a blended sentence in adult court or whether that person needs to go to prison. The direct commitment deals with putting a juvenile into a program in juvenile court. So it's not a threat to direct file any more so than when we file formal charges in adult court with the highest thing we can prove, PRR, HO, minimum mandatories. We file what we know we can prove, and we have to tell them we're thinking about putting this into adult court. Just last week, I got an email from an assistant public defender waiving the time periods, wanting to come see me about mitigation. So the defense initiates that procedure way more often than the state does. They pretty much know when we're about to direct file. They know based on the record of the offender and the charge. So that discussion comes up early, and it never, ever comes up as a threat. It's very disappointing that Rob Mason would continue to say this when his lawyers are the ones in court handling these things and thanking us for not. Let me give you an example, Melissa. Christian Fernandez, we worked with Rob Mason and Deb Ballard for 6 months. 6 full months before a decision was made to go ahead and seek an indictment and put him in adult court. 6 months we worked with them, but you never heard about that, did you? So those time periods get waived. That's not a threat. It's would a direct commitment fix Christian Fernandez? We came to the ultimate conclusion it would not. We needed more sanctions and to follow him on probation in adult court.
Another area when it comes to juvenile diversion where you felt the need to push back against criticism is civil citations. The other night, Under Sheriff Pat Ivey met with members of ICARE, an interfaith group around town, and promised more use of civil citations for juveniles, particularly nonviolent offenses. Mm-hmm. And this group has been pressing your office for some time about that issue as well, saying that that might make some progress in keeping more juveniles out of the criminal justice system. Is that something that you're looking at?
Melissa, in 2009, I sent an email to the three administrative judges in Duval, Clay, and Nassau and said, we need to expand the use of juvenile civil citations. When I took office, they were only being used in the schools. I'm the one that pushed expanding them to be used at malls, anywhere a child does a nonviolent crime. We actually go and train officers on when and how to use them. The only issue ICARE could possibly have is I won't agree to use civil citations on battery cases. They continue to confuse batteries with fighting, where two kids get in a fist fight. And we have encouraged officers, give a civil citation if it's appropriate in that. But a battery is a case where a victim gets hit, and that victim has rights. And we're going to honor the victim's rights.
Nancy Ricker quoted in the TU saying, according to Florida Department of Juvenile Justice data, less than a third of eligible youth in Duval receive civil citations. Statewide, the figure is about 43%. And she says, for this to change, we need our state attorney and sheriff to change their stances on the types of offenses that can receive civil citations. What's your response?
My response to Nancy Ricker is she ought to be thanking us for the sheer number of juvenile diversion programs that we run in our own office. Melissa, I spend about $1 million a year on 15 programs for diversion for adults and juveniles, subscribing to the philosophy that Ed Austin taught us that you always try to give somebody that first bite at the apple and get them fixed. And I have a question for Ms. Ricker and others. If civil citations are as successful as they've been touting, why did they need a law to offer a second or a third civil citation? The other thing people need to remember, a lot of these kids get in trouble in school and are handled with in-school sanctions before they ever get their first encounter with a police officer outside the school. So we look at the total record. We look at everything about a juvenile before we make a decision. And then we still divert a lot of them. If they think a civil citation keeps these kids from getting a record so they can then get a job, they better worry about Florida's public records law and social media, where the kids are putting their own business out there on YouTube and every social media everywhere. And all somebody has to do is Google a name, and you don't have to worry about a public record. You can find what somebody's done in their lifetime. So we need to fix some other laws. The simplest way to protect a juvenile's record would be to protect the sealing statutes and expungement statutes.
And let's go to your calls right now for State Attorney Angela Corey. The election's a year away, but what are your questions? Because the campaign is actually underway. 549-2937 to join the show. Paul in Orange Park. Hi, Paul. Good morning. Thanks for holding.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you. Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I missed the introductory remarks. Are we focusing only on juvenile illegal issues?
Right. Yeah, but that's all right. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm 65 and I've had 40 years of driving experience, and traffic violations are an epidemic rate, which includes teenage drivers, especially. Angela, would you think it would be a wise move to shift some of the money and police force from trying to chase down people with marijuana and instead have them out patrolling and giving people tickets to try to bring more order on the roads?
Paul, you bring up an excellent point, and thank you for that. Our traffic homicides are at an all-time high, and our officers are overwhelmed, and it's a variety of reasons. A lot of times it's just distracted driving or unsafe driving. So you've brought up an excellent point, and I know our sheriffs are addressing those issues, and we speak with them frequently. I have a lawyer dedicated to traffic homicides and really bad traffic cases that could have criminal implications. So we staff those cases frequently, and you have hit on a subject that needs a lot of attention. So I will convey your thoughts to our local law enforcement. Thank you so much for that.
And it's 549-2937 to join the show. Of course, high-profile cases get a lot of ink, whether it's Christian Fernandez, Marissa Alexander, George Zimmerman have been three cases that have gotten a lot of media attention. But your office is involved with a lot of other matters like traffic homicides. There is a lot to the prosecutor's office. As you go about the business of running it, what else is on your radar that might not actually get a lot of media attention?
Well, Melissa, like I just mentioned, all of our diversion programs, the fact that I, as the state attorney, meet with defendants and their lawyers and their families to consider waiving the minimum mandatories, which we do frequently. We waive it in the appropriate cases. That's one of the good things about our minimum mandatory statute.
What do you think about the push to do away with minimum mandatory sentencing?
I think that we would be back to the situation we were in the 80s, where we needed the minimum mandatory sentences because people who committed extremely violent crimes weren't getting enough time. So the beauty of this law is we have the discretion to waive it when appropriate. And we've done it on numerous occasions. We did it in the beginning on Marissa Alexander, but people just don't want to recognize what we're doing. And, we just got $2 million to handle cold case rapes, and we've already started implementing that grant. And so there's a lot of good things going on, but people continue to focus on misinformation on a couple of cases. And we just hope that when people have questions, they'll email, call, or look at our website, www.saofourth.com. Tells a lot about what's going on in the state attorney's office.
Scott is in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Scott.
Hello?
Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm from Jacksonville, Florida, and I was wondering about the teen court program that's going on in my city. I've heard that funding is being cut from it soon, and I know that my life has been changed by it. So I was wondering if that's going to continue on and be a part for youth.
Yes, Scott, I'm so glad you brought that up, and I'm glad it changed your life. Teen Court is a great one of our diversion programs. We are trying to help with the funding for that, and our office is part in that as we send referrals. We refer kids that need Teen Court. It is thriving in Clay and Nassau County as well, which is in our circuit. And I'm not sure exactly where the funding is to this day, but I recently spoke to the chief judge about pledging our commitment to helping continue with that program. It gets kids involved, and it lets them sit on both sides of the table, so to speak. And it has actually inspired some kids to go on and want to be lawyers or police officers or judges. So it's a great program, and thank you for participating in it.
Thanks, Scott. And we'll go back to your calls, emails, and tweets in just a moment for State Attorney Angela Corey. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. Calls to 549-2937. You've taken criticism in a couple of national media stories recently as well for the number of death penalty cases in this area. Duval County is one of the leading counties in America. The second highest producer of death sentences per capita, actually, after Caddo Parish, Louisiana. You've secured more death sentences than any other prosecutor in Florida. What do you say to critics of your aggressiveness in pursuing the death penalty?
Well, my philosophy on the death penalty hasn't changed, and I worked under two prior state attorneys where it was pretty much in line with what they were doing. It's very disingenuous for the former state attorney to come out now and criticize our stance on the death penalty when in 2009, 10, and 11, the death penalty sentences we received were filed on his watch, and the death notices were filed on his watch. So I've seen that press that he's created. It's ridiculous in light of the fact that we seek the death penalty. We don't impose it. And it has to be ratified by a jury and then a judge. And we have had numerous high-profile murders, repeat offender murders. Everyone knows that we have a lot of murders in Duval County, so you would expect it to be fairly high across the board in tough sentences, because we also are among the leaders in sending people to state prison for violent crimes. And I want to disabuse people of the myth that we send nonviolent drug offenders to state prison. That is not true. The people going to prison are robbers, rapists, and murderers, people who burglarize homes with guns. They're a tough group, and they need to go to prison.
Are you saying Duval County has more violent offenders than any other city, or that we need more death penalty cases than other cities?
I'm saying that we take a close look at everything, Melissa. We weigh aggravation and mitigation, and Duval has always kind of led the state. Across the board in tough sentences. Northeast Florida was one of the reasons that we went to guideline sentencing, because we were always so tough up here, and further south they weren't as tough, so they had to standardize sentencing somewhat. So Northeast Florida has always been considered tough on sentencing and a leader in sending violent and repeat offenders to prison, as well as putting people on death row. But the philosophy has not changed. We still go according to the statute, weighing aggravation against mitigation. And if the aggravation for the murder outweighs mitigation, we seek the death penalty. We don't impose it. We seek it.
Mike on the West Side. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a point that the criticism with regards to filing the death penalty wasn't the only issue with regards to death penalty cases. The other issue was that in at least one of the articles, is that we have one of the five worst setups for defense counsel for death penalty cases. In fact, when Matt Shirk took over the office, all of your certified death penalty attorneys were fired, and none of them were hired back. So that pretty much gives you all the advantages with regards to handling death penalty cases. And I think that if you're going to put some people to death, I think we all understand that they're violent offenders and there are things that probably need to be done in the legal system. But when the deck is stacked so heavily against them, including providing them with overworked and incompetent counsel, I think, and I don't know that they're all incompetent, but they are all overworked. And I think that that's one of the things that you need to address with regards to the death penalty issue and the criticisms that have been lodged.
And Mike, thank you for bringing that up. And I will tell you, as a prosecutor of 34 years, we always want to try a case against the best defense counsel that we can. The first death penalty case that I tried, Mr. Eller and two other excellent lawyers from the Public Defender's Office defended a man in Clay County, Michael Jackson, and Dan Skinner and I prosecuted that case, and we were seeking death because he had a prior very violent crime. They did an excellent job for their client. Every case is handled on a case-by-case basis. The public defender is not the only entity that handles death penalty cases. You have regional conflict counsel and private court-appointed attorneys who represent indigent people charged with death penalty cases, and they try a significant number of our death penalty cases. The public defender is not the only entity that tries those, but I know that there are some things being looked at. We are actually appealing one of the decisions that involved Mr. Eller, and you have to remember, some of the lawyers that worked in the former administration for the public defender also have taken the stand and admitted that they did not give their client the representation they deserved. And I know of at least one that got off of death row because of that. So we look at this, it's been a historic thing, but we are looking at it, Mike, and thank you for calling.
Jay tweets the show, Jacksonville leads in the use of the death penalty, but the violence continues. How does the state attorney square being tough on crime, but with a lack of results?
Well, we don't have a lack of results, and I'm sorry that's how you feel. We have violent crime is actually down. Our homicide rate has not climbed like it has in other cities, especially if you compare where we were to where we are now. We are keeping our violent crime at a rate that we can handle. We have a large number of homicides, but compared to Baltimore, Chicago, and other places, we are doing quite well. And those are places, obviously Baltimore is one that would be similar sort of in the size of our jurisdiction and that sort of thing. We also are using our PRR, prison releasee reoffender laws, and the minimum mandatory laws to put the most violent people away. Our juvenile cases have been cut in half. People don't realize that. When I started, we opened 6,000 juvenile cases, and that was consistent with the former administration. We only open about 3,000 now. So we are making changes in a positive direction. Unfortunately, you just don't hear about them often enough.
Here's a tweet from Julie. Does the state attorney have an opinion on whether Florida juries should be unanimous to send death penalty defendants to death?
We follow the law. Obviously, I'm a law enforcer. That's my job as state attorney. My opinion is that I believe a majority opinion of a jury is sufficient. Melissa, right now, people can go back and take one vote back in that jury room. And even if somebody were to be pushed to follow the law, you know, and say the aggravation actually outweighs the mitigation, I think once it reaches a majority, some people don't feel like they have to. I think that it will, obviously, if that law passes, we'll do our jobs. We will always do our jobs under the laws that we're given. So,
Pat in Neptune Beach. Hi, Pat. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm not the public speaker, but I'll try to keep this succinct. I've given a tremendous amount of thought to what goes on here in Jacksonville and in our public schools and with our minority population. I have for many years. I've worked in the Duval County schools off and on since 1977. I've lived out of state for many years. And I often feel that these kind of programs really spend a tremendous amount of money on where we could direct it, where it should begin, very, very early and in the public schools. And one of the things I think that could really help, I've never seen a kindergartner that came into a school that wanted to fail. And I've seen many, many 7- and 8- and 9-year-olds that have lost their motivation to succeed. And it's because we fail them in the public schools. We fail them in many ways. But one of the things that we can do to start to turn the tide in Duval County is to have an excellent guidance system where we can give emotional support to children right when they enter in the schools. We have very little guidance in this school system, and I can think that we can possibly redirect a lot of the money that goes for administration and put it into guidance, hiring some of the best guidance counselors in the country. We can start there. It's a very complex problem. We all know that. But diversion programs that start when these kids are teenagers, it's really too late. Let's give them success when they walk into school. Let's don't fail them. And I'm telling you, you can turn them around. I've been a foster mother. I know. So I really hope that we'll start redirecting a lot of this money into where it needs to go. Thank you.
Pat, thank you. That's an amazing comment. And we do want these kids to get the attention they need early. I keep telling people, fix these kids and put us out of the juvenile business. We'd be happy. But I will tell you that because the home environment is so important to a child's success, we bring the parents into our diversion programs. Alan Lauder runs our diversion programs, and he deals with the parents as well as the children, because we believe in order for a child to learn from their mistakes and thrive, the parents have to help them and be there virtually every day to give that child structure and keep them on the right path. So we're very proud of our juvenile diversion programs. And believe it or not, Pat, we don't start them in their teen years. We have a lot of 8, 9, and 10, and 11-year-old kids who come in for diversion programs.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. As I said, the election is a year away. Hopefully both you and your challenger will appear again in the intervening months. But thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. I enjoyed it.
We were joined by State Attorney Angela Corey this morning. Much more still ahead. Later, a preview of The Whale. That's the new show opening this weekend at the Five and Dime Theater. But up next, First Coast author Meg Haston on her success in the young adult world. We'll hear about her new novel, Paperweight, looking at one girl's struggle with an eating disorder. That's after this.
Knock, knock. Who's there? Obama. Obama who?
It just feels good to admire somebody.
No joke. Author Marilyn Robinson tells the story of talking one-on-one with President Obama about the future of American democracy. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Daniel Austin. On the next episode of WJCT's Hometown, be inspired by Jacksonville Beach artist Jean LaJoy. Be transformed by local photographer Christina Karst. Filmmakers Keegan Ann Fuso and Drew Brown of Gray Area Films shed light on an untold story. And local artist Jeff Lukey shares Girl with Flowers. Explore the people, places, and events in your hometown. Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
WJZT and the Florida Theater present Clifford the Big Red Dog live at the Florida Theater on Sunday, November 15th at 2 and 5 p.m. Call the Florida Theater box office at 904-355-2787.
Welcome back. Young adult author Meg Haston is based here in Jacksonville. She first achieved literary fame with her How to Rock series. The first book in the series was called How to Rock, Braces and Glasses. That story became a hit TV show on Nickelodeon. Haston's newest, Paperweight, is a young adult novel winning raves for its portrayal of 17-year-old Stevie, a girl undergoing eating disorder treatment at a center in New Mexico. With more about Paperweight and her career, Meg Haston joins us now in studio. Good morning, Meg.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. So tell me a little bit about Stevie, this character in Paperweight.
So Stevie, as you mentioned, her father checks her into inpatient eating disorder treatment at the very start of the book, and she's incredibly resistant to treatment at the start of the book. And so she, at the start of the story, is angry and doesn't want to be there, as we see with clients going into treatment so much of the time. And so as she goes in, she meets her therapist, whom she refers to as Shrink. And throughout the novel, we sort of alternate back and forth between Stevie's time in treatment and her developing relationship with Shrink. And then we also go back in time and see some of the family dynamics and events that have brought Stevie to treatment in the first place.
And you tell the story in flashback
Yes.
Slowly we learn the reason why Stevie developed an eating disorder.
Yes. One of the triggers for her unhealthy behaviors was the death of her brother, Josh, which we learn happened almost a year prior to the start of the story and the start of her treatment process. And so she feels responsible for Josh's death and feels incredibly guilty about the manner in which he died, which becomes clear as we go back in flashbacks and see Stevie interacting with her family and see her relationship with Josh. And so she goes into treatment actually with the intention of ending her own life on the one-year anniversary of Josh's death.
She wants to starve herself to death.
Yes, she does. Yeah.
Why did you choose this subject of eating disorders, which afflict so many young women as subject matter?
It does. Well, it's one that's of personal interest to me. I'm a woman in recovery myself. And so as both a recovered woman and as a therapist, this project gave me the opportunity to look at this issue from kind of two different ways. So from the perspective of a sick patient working to get well and the perspective of a therapist working to help heal.
So, you had an eating disorder when you were younger?
I did, yes.
Were you anorexic or bulimic?
Actually, my diagnosis was eating disorder not otherwise specified, which is there's a large number of women and men that would fall into that category, meaning that there's elements of different behaviors that are part of that diagnosis.
And what do you think sparked your eating disorder?
Oh, gosh, that would be a tricky question for anybody. So I don't know that there's a simple answer to that.
For young girls, it's all about control, though, isn't it? Having some measure of control when they feel out of control, building self-esteem in a world where they don't really have a lot of it and where they're bombarded with images of how they're supposed to look.
I think that can certainly be an element that finding something in a tumultuous life experience or family situation that you can control. We also more and more are coming to realize some of the biological links, some of the things that are going on chemically in the brain with, mm-hmm. with young women and men who develop eating disorders. So,
yeah. So before you wrote Paperweight, though, you first really broke out with your How to Rock series of books. And the first one was called How to Rock, Braces, and Glasses.
Yes. So for a different subject matter for a different audience.
Yeah. How exciting was that to see that take off? And then Nickelodeon did a television treatment of it.
They did. And it was so much fun to watch. And folks often want to know sort of what my role was in the television process. And unfortunately, the book and the TV show are two pretty different processes, but it was so fantastic to see it come on to the screen and see what the writers, how they brought it to life in a different way.
And it's exciting to have a young adult author in our area achieve so much success.
Thank you. I'm incredibly proud of this project. And as I've mentioned, it's really a personal subject for me. So I'm proud to put it out there. It's kind of soul-bearing in a way, even though Stevie's story is not in any way my story. But obviously, the book was inspired by...
Well, all young girls are in a lot of pain, I think. Adolescence is tough for all young girls.
It is.
And you've really managed to find a way to tap that vein of angst and discontent in a unique voice. Is it because of the struggles that you had as a teen that you have this special gift, do you think?
Well, it could be, and I also work with teenagers
and you
in
work
my
with them
work
now.
As a counselor, yes. And so I think that keeps me sort of engaged in how teenagers think. So I hope that I can always hold on to that.
Do you enjoy writing?
I love to write. I read a quote by Judy Blume not too long ago that said something to the effect of, I like more having written something than the process, because the process itself can be painful and isolating and slow. But I do love to write at some points more than others.
I grew up reading Judy Blume.
Oh, me too. That's one of my favorite.
Did she inspire you?
Yes. I think she's sort of like the quintessential, or one of them, young adult authors. I remember when I was younger, I used to fake sick so I could stay at home and read my Judy Blume.
And now you're on the path to being a sort of the Judy Blume for this new generation.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
You really are.
I hope so. I mean, I think one of her greatest strengths was she really captured that adolescent voice. And so that's something that I'm always working to do.
Well, we're going to listen to a little of that voice right now because Meg has agreed to read an excerpt from her new novel, Paperweight. Let's listen.
Okay, so this is the very start of the novel. Day one, Friday, July 4th, 1:34 p.m. 27 days to freedom, and I am caged. Suspended in a boxy aluminum prison with gray cloth seats and the synthetic stench of piña colada swinging from the rear view. Joshua, would say that I'm being a drama queen. I imagine him saying things like that sometimes. It's not like I can actually hear his words out loud or he comes to me in my dreams or anything like that. But if I'm really still, I can almost hear him. The closer I get to the anniversary, the more I'm trying. I pretend that he's next to me on our rotted wood balcony before dawn when my shallow breath rattle is the only sound. I conjure him up in the middle of the night and he's sitting next to me in the bed when I'm dizzy and sick with Eden and booze. I imagine him rubbing my back in easy circles, whispering these sweet French lullabies our mother used to sing. I can almost feel the warmth of his hand. I wish he were here now to calm me. I am a hostage in the passenger seat of a white minivan, trapped next to a strange woman with cotton candy hair the color of ginger ale. She's telling me about her granddaughter's masterful performance in the role of Velma Kelly in her middle school production of Chicago. As if we were old friends, as if I didn't see her activate the child lock the second we pulled out of the airport parking lot. In old movies, men in white coats cart the crazies away. I get a woman in a white minivan. Just such a vivid performance, Cotton Candy's pearly pink acrylics tapped the steering wheel at exactly the 10 and 2 positions. She really transformed herself into the part. Bill, that's my husband, he got the whole thing on the camcorder. I glare out the window at the infinite stretch of two-lane highway. The flat New Mexico desert looks like a kid's drawing. Swirls of waxy blue sky over jagged red dirt, leaning cacti like somebody just plunked them down without bothering to make sure they were screwed in right. I even see the wavy heat lines like when Josh and our dad used to barbecue behind the house on Broad. But then I blink, and they're gone.
And that's the opening of Paperweight.
You
know, what's exciting about this book, too, is that you don't really dwell so much on the disease, but rather Stevie's recovery. It's a hopeful story.
It is. And I'm always hesitant when I say this is a book about grief and loss, and it is in many ways. Stevie's had a lot of loss in her life, and we watch the way in which that unfolded for her. But I think that it's ultimately a story about human resilience and strength and healing and how healing healthy relationships can be for us. And so I think that's one of the reasons that even if a teenager hasn't struggled with an eating disorder or doesn't know someone who has, my hope would be that some of the themes in this book are universal and that readers will connect with that theme of resilience and hope.
Well, I'm very excited that you signed a copy for my daughter.
Thank you. I hope she enjoys it. You'll have to let me know.
I think she will. I know she will, in fact. And it's a delight to meet you. You are based here in our area. And I'm sure you'll keep writing, so we look forward to the next one. But for now, the new novel is Paperweight by the First Coast's own Meg Haston. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And coming up, a preview of The Whale. That's the new show opening this weekend at the city's Five and Dime Theater. Keep listening.
Sweeping changes could be in store for Duval Public Schools. School zone boundary shifts, school uniforms, and underperforming schools being converted into special academies. WJCT's Community Thread invites the community to join in one big conversation with Duval County Superintendent Nikolai Vitti. Log on to wjct.org/communitythread to submit your questions or RSVP to be a part of our studio audience on November 12th.
Tough times on Wall Street hit everybody, from investment bankers to the guy who sells them a slice of pizza every day for lunch.
Wall Street, that's the trend. It goes up, but it goes down, and it is getting slower and slower.
What isn't slowing down is our coverage of the news that matters. We'll tell you why the stocks swing and how to make sense of it on Marketplace. Business news for the rest of us. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Listen to After Hours to relax with music that spans the world in all styles from classical to doo-wop. Weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's the story of a 600-pound man who's hidden away from the world in his small apartment. Charlie is a literature professor, but he's estranged from his teenage daughter, eating his way into oblivion, yet still desperate to connect with his child and others before it's too late. That's the premise behind a new production opening this weekend at Jacksonville's Five and Dime Theater. The show is called The Whale. Joining us now, star Bill Ratliff and director Juan Unzueta. Guys, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Bill, you're not overweight. Well, you must be wearing some serious prosthetics in this production.
We actually, we've rented the fat suit that was used in the original production in at Playwrights Horizon in New York. And so it's top quality fat suit.
Oh,
if you're in the fat
top
suit
of
business.
The line. But how heavy is it?
Well, I think it starts at about 50 pounds. And then by the end of the show, it's probably at about 70 because it's... It's a little hot.
I would guess.
Sweat quite a bit into it, so it gets heavier over the time.
So you're really sacrificing for your art here.
I sure am, and people should appreciate that.
Juan, tell me about the story. Charlie, of course, is the protagonist of
The
Whale.
Right. It's a 5-character show. We've got Charlie, his daughter Ellie, that he is desperate to reconnect with here. The play follows 5 days in his life, Monday to Friday. And his best friend, Liz, who is a nurse and who helps to care for him. Additionally, there's his ex-wife, who makes an appearance later in the play. And there is a young Mormon on his mission who we meet that has made it his mission to get Charlie
to try to convert Charlie into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And does Charlie resist that?
Yes, he's got great reason to, which you know one will discover as they watch the show.
So so this play has ties to people that have become disaffected with the Mormon church. Is that part of the story?
Certainly there are elements of that. There's sort of an LGBT kind of angle as well. But I think really at the core of it, it's human experience, and it's the way that momentous events in your past can really affect how you choose to continue on with the rest of your life.
So tell me about, Bill, what it's like to play this character. Charlie is a morbidly obese gay man who's actually, as we learn, he's dying. He's not well. He's sick.
He's very, very sick. And he's, through the course of the show, I think, ready to let go. And but I guess the core of playing it is that he is very sick. And he, one thing that's great about it, I don't have but about four pieces of blocking in the entire show because he's basically immobile. He's so large that he can't get around.
So do you do a lot of it sitting down?
All of it.
Okay.
Almost all of it. But then, obviously there are physical problems that he has. He can't breathe well. He wheezes. He's You know, and the few times when he does have to get up to move, it's got to be, you know, the pain of that has to show through. And so...
So the fat is sort of the physical manifestation of his pain.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's a metaphor, too, for a societal metaphor for everything that just gets stacked up on top of people emotionally.
And Juan, is this play about redemption, too, that a soul can be redeemed, whether it's through a church or in some other way?
There's certainly that sense of mending these human connections that got away from him in his life, and I think that's one of the beautiful things about it.
What's it like to direct a show like this? A small group of characters.
Yeah,
it's really about the character interaction.
Absolutely, it's a very contemporary play in that it really is. I mean, granted, some of the things that are happening in the show are elevated for it is theater, but it's very real. And that was my biggest goal with this, was just to, you know, keep reminding our actors that to ground what you're doing in reality, and these are conversations that we could hear at any time. It's really just a window onto contemporary life.
And the Five and Dime Theater has really built a reputation in Jacksonville for doing leading productions, leading-edge productions. The Five and Dime doesn't have a physical theater of its own. It moves around town. This most recent production will be done at the Church of the Good Shepherd on Stockton Street. Can you talk a little bit about the mission and the values of the Five and Dime?
You know, I think they're really wanting to stimulate positive community thought and change in Jacksonville. You're right, they do really fresh things artistically, and we're just really proud to be part of one of their productions.
Right. I don't know that Juan and I can necessarily speak to their mission, because Juan and I aren't a part of the Five and Dime, you know, the group of people that run the Five and Dime. But yeah, it's just really trying to keep things contemporary. I think they like to do small shows that can move around town easily, or just go up easily wherever they happen to be.
They're really like pop up shows,
because
every time they do one, it's in a different venue. They've done some here in our building.
Yep, and it's great socially conscious work, which I think, you know, makes it even more important, you know, that we tell these stories.
It has to be rewarding to work on something like that. And as you said, you imported the fat suit down from New York. Was it an off Broadway show?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so successful in New York.
Yes, very.
Yeah, a big hit up there. So it's exciting to have it here in Jacksonville. So when you take the fat suit off at the end of the night, what's that like?
Well, that's difficult to describe, but it's as soon as the last line is said and the lights go down, it's like, get this thing off of me.
I was like, get Bill out of the suit.
Get him out.
I guess that gives you an appreciation for what it's like for someone who's overweight and struggling to lose the weight, though, right?
It's, it's truly miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, not, I just, it's very difficult to deal with. I can't imagine, you know, this is a 600-pound man. I just can't imagine.
Well, people will imagine it, though, when they see your performance on stage, because The Whale is debuting this Friday night in Riverside at the Church of the Good Shepherd. And Juan, this only runs 2 weekends, correct?
We're Friday to Sunday this week and the following week. Discount tickets are still available through Thursday of this week at www.thefiveanddime.org.
That's The Whale, debuting this Friday, November 13th at the Five and Dime Theater. The show at Worsham Hall at the Church of the Good Shepherd on Stockton Street. Get your tickets now at the Five and Dime. That's the number 5anddime.org. Star Bill Ratliff and director Juan Unzueta. Break a leg, guys, although you won't, because you'll be sitting down the whole time.
Well, yeah, that wouldn't be tragic.
Yes, but enjoy, and thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program. Thanks so much for listening this morning, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Well, next on Diane Rehm, the president of the University of Missouri system has resigned, and the chancellor of the university's main campus in Columbia has also announced he's stepping down. Their moves are in response to student protesters who charged that the university failed to adequately respond to recent racial incidents. Racial tensions on campus and the debate over the university administration's response. That conversation is coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.